It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the organizing committee and the program chairs for inviting me to come and talk. When they first invited me, I was a little unsure as to whether a talk like this, which we discussed, would be appropriate for this community, but then they assured me, well, everybody votes, and there are some networking aspects to this, too, and I'll mention a couple of those, but mostly voting is on other things, but we'll talk about some of the network questions, too. But my interest is security of voting systems. The outline for the talk is a little bit about voting in general, and then the question is how to make voting better. Clearly, voting needs work, and all of us with technical backgrounds can try to make it better. Here's some ideas that have been proposed for making voting better. Internet voting, which, sad to say, I won't talk too much about because I don't think it's a good idea. Voter-verified paper audit trails. Voting with cryptography, which is sort of an area that I care a lot about from even my background. And voting system standards, which, as Hari said, I do work on. Just as a caveat, the lawyers make me say these things. Anything I say here is my own opinion and not the opinion of any committee I happen to serve on or anything like that. So voting is obviously important for lots of organizations, companies, and it's actually a very easy problem until you start thinking about security. Then it gets very hard very quickly. Security makes this really tough because the requirements are contradictory. We have a long history of election fraud in this country. If you read the New York Times this morning, it was one of the front page articles about how much voter fraud there is in this country and so on, too. There's a wonderful book that I recommend you read if you like reading anecdotes. You know, Steal This Vote, which is a book that's title is a little more sensational than the book itself, but it has all kinds of wonderful history. You see the voting fraud and voting election fraud is a long history, and I wouldn't say honorable history, but in this country. Some of the anecdotes I like, there's this one politician, the governor of Louisiana, who said he wanted to be buried in Louisiana so he could continue to stay active in politics and vote, you know. And then there's the famous quote by Boss Tweed, also attributed to Stalin, which says, you know, those who vote determine nothing. Those who count the votes determine everything. All too often true. In the early days, voting was entirely public. You go to your town hall, and you raise your hand if you're in favor of so-and-so, and then the votes are counted. So it was entirely clear who you voted for. Wasn't particularly secure. There was no voter privacy, et cetera. But that's how it was done. Classic painting. Voting has tended to follow technology. So in the early days, the Greeks used to take bits of shattered pot and throw them in one side or another using stones. Paper has been around for a long time. Paper voting is still very popular, and maybe deservedly so. We'll talk about some of the properties of paper. Lever machines. My folks in New York just moved away from lever machines. Connecticut also just finally sold off their lever machines. Punch cards are now out. Optical scan, paper-based things are being used widely. Things are getting computerized at a very rapid rate, and the internet and networking certainly is on the horizon as something people talk about trying to do. Punch cards are out. Voter-verified paper trails are hot. We'll have some charts talking about this. But the big question in the minds of election officials, and there's lots of questions about voting, but one they care about most is it possible to get rid of all that paper? Election officials dislike having to manage and store, you know, all that paper. Can we make everything electronic somehow and have its security and all the nice properties? That would be ideal for them. Unfortunately, life isn't so simple, and we'll talk about some of the issues. Voting technology has changed, and it keeps changing. 1980, it sort of looked like this. The red areas are punch card. Those have totally disappeared, right? Blue are lever machines. Those have mostly disappeared. You know, the orange is paper ballots. Right, and then we switch to 2004, we've got a map that looks very different. The green is optical scan. You see that things are very fragmented. That's one of the terrible things about this business, is that many states give the authority to pick voting equipment to the counties, and the poor voting system salesmen have to go county by county by county to try to sell their stuff. So you end up with a funny patchwork picture like this. So, but you can see in 2004, it's a lot of op scan stuff, the green, electronic touchscreen stuff, which is the purple, and a few lever machines left over. The latest picture would look a little bit different because those lever machines would go away. And some of the states that went for electronic touchscreen stuff have backed off and gone to paper, too. Just a point I think it's important to make. It's not all about technology. Often these discussions are phased entirely in terms of technology. But you know, it's really the election officials and poll workers that are the heart and soul of the system. And I encourage you to be a poll worker if you can sometime in your own state. It's an interesting experience and very educational. Here's some poll workers putting together a network for networking the electronic poll books together that the people register at. So whatever technology gets adopted has to be something that can be used by these kinds of folks that are maybe not so technical. There's a lot happening in voting. There's legislation. There's an interesting bill that Rush Holt of New Jersey has put out now. I guess the second one. The first line was the 2002 bill, which passed, which created the committee I'm on, the Standards Committee, the TGDC, gave $4 billion to the states to spend before the standards got proposed, so it's a little backwards, and has lots of other requirements for making voting accessible for people with disabilities and so on. More recently, the Holt bill before Congress looks like it may even pass, mandates paper ballots or voter-verified paper records for electronic machines, and does a lot of other things like make the paper ballots the permanent record, requires disclosure of source code for voting machines, and requires certain kinds of auditing, levels of auditing. There's a lot of research going on. The Accurate Project, chaired by Avi Rubin, got about $7.5 million, a multi-university project to study voting systems. There's the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project that's been in business since 2001. There's the standards committees that were mentioned, which are trying to develop new standards for, and I'll talk more about these later, for voting systems to be certified. Voting systems generally need to be certified to be used, and that means they have to pass some minimum bar of acceptability. There's a lot of activist groups that have been effective at getting things done. Carter Baker Commission proposing voter ID cards, et cetera, et cetera. This, if you read the papers at all, you see this is an area of active interest and development, both technically, politically, everything else. So it's a hard problem. So when you start thinking about this academically, you start listing the requirements. What do you need to make a voting system work? There's lots of moving parts, some of which are people, some of which are the components that you're building. There's the voter registration system. Probably the biggest single problem we have in voting systems today are voter registration problems, voter registration databases that are not up to date. People go to the polls, they find they can't vote because they're not in the database, even though they think they should be. The point of a voter registration system, of course, is to make sure each voter eligible voter votes at most once. Integrity, of course, is essential. Votes shouldn't be changed, modified, deleted, whatever, once they're cast. And you want to have some auditability properties so that you know that the votes cast are counted properly. Voter privacy is the most important property, or the most difficult property to meet. It's the one that ends up being contradictory to the other properties we have. It should be the case that no one can tell how any voter voted, even if the voter wants that person to know how they voted. So if the voter's trying to sell their vote, the going price for a vote for president might be $20 or something. If they want to sell their vote, is there some way that they can prove how they voted to somebody else? That should be preserved in spite of even the voter's wishes otherwise. So that's the property that I view as being the one that makes voting really tough, because it makes various kinds of audits and controls tough, because to have the kind of controls you'd have to violate voter privacy. And then there's a bunch of other properties that are important: availability, reliability, ease of use, both for voters and poll workers, accessibility for voters with disabilities. This is a big area and a tough one. When you start thinking about how a blind voter verifies their vote and so on, too, you get to some very interesting questions. Transparency, the system should be understandable to the average voter and poll worker and so on. So these are some of the requirements. There's lots more you could list. So when you start thinking about security, you ask, well, who are the potential adversaries? When you start looking at security, you want to know who might want to defeat the security properties, the integrity properties, the confidentiality properties of this system. And, well, it's easy to start making a list. You may even have political zealots who want to fix the result in favor of their own favorite candidate. Foreign powers who, maybe you want to change the election. If all your voting machines are made abroad, as a lot of electronics are these days, you start wondering, what could they do if they tweak the voting machine software, hardware somehow. So the results affect them. The voters are adversarial. They may wish to sell their votes. As I said, we have a long tradition of vote selling in this country, which ought to be suppressed. And so you want to, you have to view them as adversarial as well. The election officials, some of them may have gone sour or gone bad on you, and you have to worry about what they could do. They're given a lot of trust and responsibility. The vendors, you have to worry about the evil insider in the vendor, the software programmer who's put an Easter egg or some sort of thing in the code that somehow gets through all the certification checks. Hackers, malcontents, anarchists, and so on, too. So, really, almost anybody is an adversary here, which makes it interesting, right? So you don't have any trusted third parties. You know, there's no source of trust. Everybody's checking on each other, really, in a good voting system. And some of these adversaries may have lots of resources, right? I mean, it's possible that, you know, given the amount of money that goes into politics these days, you know, spending tens of millions of dollars to fix an election might be a plausible proposal for somebody. Back to the question I raised earlier, is electronic voting trustworthy? You know, if you don't have any paper, you know, we've seen a number of fiascos with electronic voting, in Sarasota being the most recent one. If you want to call that a fiasco in terms of the equipment or in terms of the ballot design, that's probably what it was. But you have no paper record to check on what happened there. You've got a machine making some electronic record, and you wonder, is that right? If you've got a system which is software-based, they're getting to be hundreds of thousands of lines of code, how do you tell if it's doing the right thing? How do you provide? I mean, they may be perfectly secure and correct, but there's also the question of how do you provide the assurance that they're secure and correct, which is a different question and one that you have to address if you're looking at standards. You have to have some process by which people can test that these machines really are doing what they're supposed to be doing, and that's obviously very hard. There's lots of machines out there being run by people who aren't so technical and who don't have a lot of training, perhaps. And the certification process, which is in the process of being improved, has been traditionally very weak at doing any kind of check at all on the security properties of the software. The big question is the vote cast equal to the vote recorded for a machine like this? How do you know that the bits that could change in the back end correspond to what you saw on the screen in the front end? So, lots of good questions. How do we make voting better? So I want to talk about a number of ideas that have been proposed in some depth. So, internet voting, we'll talk about that briefly. Voter-verified paper audit trails, which is probably the most popular theme these days for fixing voting. And then some things looking further out, voting with cryptography, which is the area that I care about. You know, is there a way that cryptography could play some sort of special role in voting, give us nice properties? And cryptography's turned out to be a marvelously flexible and adaptable set of tools where even with very contradictory requirements, you can often come up with interesting solutions that meet these contradictory requirements. So we'll talk about some approaches there, mixed nets, public mixing. And then a recent approach I came up with, which doesn't use crypto at all, called three ballot, which is kind of funky, and maybe you'll enjoy seeing that. And then better voting system standards, we'll talk a little bit about that. So that's some of the outline here. So internet voting. I really only have one slide on internet voting. So the bottom line is internet voting is vote by mail made worse. So what do I mean by that? So vote by mail is becoming popular as well, and I think that's bad. What is the problem with vote by mail? Vote by mail is, I really think it's important that voters have an enforced moment of privacy to cast their vote, free of bribery and coercion. Right? One of the problems you have with voting, of course, is that voters, if you're going to have them cast a vote, cast their intentions, they have to have this moment where they're alone. They shouldn't be with their spouse, with their coworker, with their boss, with their religious leader, with their union boss or whatever. They should be on their own casting their vote. This moment of privacy, I view as being a very important part of the whole voting process. So it's a lesson we've learned from hard experience. I think vote by mail is a step backwards in that. You know, I predict we'll have scandals where you have entire nursing homes voting the same way or entire, you know, other organizations of various sorts voting the same way because of various forms of coercion or just fraud. I think having the voter alone at the poll site, when possible, I mean, some people can't make it to the polls, and they ought to have some other mechanism, but having that moment of privacy is important. So vote by mail violates that. Voting over the internet has all of those problems, plus all of the problems of computer security. So that's what I mean when I say internet voting is vote by mail made worse. I love this quote by Vint Cerf, which says 1 in 4 PCs belongs to a botnet. Right? If that's true, that's a huge voting block. Right? You could imagine trying to... It's obvious what you can do with that, right? So you got voting software on the PC and the bots. Just tweak your vote a little bit. So I'm not a fan of internet voting. Whenever people propose this idea to me, I say, that's still a long ways off. We've got a lot of problems with basic computer security to handle first. It's the platform security I worry about more than the network security, but all of those matter. So internet voting, if somebody proposes that to you, tell them it's at least a decade or two off, and it may be more. Maybe we'll get there someday. You know, at some point, you may want to have your cell phone really be a trusted agent for you, so it's a secure platform for running applications like voting or other things. But I think we're a ways from that yet. It's not inconceivable, but it's not near term either. So that's one approach to making voting better, and again, that's long-term research, I think, on computer platform security. Voter-verified paper audit trails have been around for the last decade at least. You've got an electronic machine which is producing, and here's a picture of a typical one. Many of you have voted on these kinds of machines. You vote on the screen, you touch your votes, and then to know that there's at least one record of your vote that's really what it's supposed to be, there's a printed record on the side. You can see this little widget on the side here that there's a little window you look through and you see the printed paper audit trail, and if you approve of it, then it prints approved at the bottom and marches on. So the voter, if she wishes, can be assured that there's one record that's correct of her vote, and then you can use statistical auditing sampling techniques to ensure that the paper records match the electronic records well enough and proceed with the electronic records as the official count. And the paper records merely as a check on them. And there have been many states now that have adopted voter-verified paper audit trails as mandatory, some of them throwing away their electronic machines altogether and just saying that was a waste and buying new machines. But they're not perfect. It's not a panacea. And so these things, voter-verified paper audit trails, are helpful. They give you confidence that even in spite of problems with the software, that a correct record was made of your vote, but it doesn't solve all the problems. You still have to store all those paper ballots now. You have to store them securely. I mean, if you have all those nice paper ballots and both the electronic records and the paper records end up in the river, you haven't gained anything. Here's a classic case of ballot box ending up in San Francisco Bay, of course. This two-step procedure may be awkward for some voters. You have to look at the screen, look at the paper and so on too. In some cases, you have to take the paper and insert it somewhere else. There's a variety of different ways that these schemes can be architected. They can be just procedurally awkward for voters. And it doesn't catch other kinds of problems. There may be a candidate that was just missing from the list. If you have a list of 200 candidates for recall on the governor's list, you wouldn't notice if one was missing maybe unless you're voting for that candidate. Malicious voters can cause a denial of service by casting suspicion on the voting machine. If the voting machine prints something that's different than what the screen shows, then of course the voter ought to protest. Of course, then it gives the voter an opportunity. Remember, the voter's an adversary too. The voter can protest maliciously and say, this machine isn't printing what I said. And either the voter has to violate his own privacy to show, here's the screen, here's the paper, or the voter has to protest without having the evidence to preserve his privacy. So you have a problem potentially there with voters causing machines to be pulled out of service inappropriately. But if you think about voting as a large-scale system, the thing that VVPATs don't help with are the end-to-end properties you might want to have out of voting. So if you look at what's happening with voting, you want voting to be private so the voter is really a casting according to their intentions. And then you want VVPAT helps ensure that votes are cast as intended, as recorded as intended. So you've got some record that the voter knows was really a correct capturing of their intent. But it doesn't help ensure that votes are counted as cast. As I said, all these votes may end up in the river. Right? So if you look at the end-to-end issue, how do you ensure that the correct votes get from the voter's head all the way to the final tally at the end? So crypto proposals are one approach to dealing with this end-to-end security property that you might want to have. And let's talk a bit about some of those. So there's three types of crypto-based voting protocols in the literature. One is blind signature-based, one is homomorphic encryption, and one uses mixnets. And I'll talk mostly about mixnets. The other two have had some success with preliminary implementations and so on, too, but they're not quite as robust. The blind signature-based one was actually implemented here at MIT and used it for student elections for a while. And it basically has a trusted authority that accepts submissions of the ballots, signs them, and the signature scheme is a blind signature scheme so that the trusted authority can sign the ballot for the voter without knowing how the voter voted, because the votes are blinded ahead of time. And then the voter, when it gets the signed ballot back, can remove the blinding without removing the signature. That's the beautiful property of some of these crypto schemes. And then you have a signed ballot that the voter then submits through some sort of anonymization channel. And all the ballots then are signed by the same authority, so there's no identification as to who voted. but you can tell they're authentic. So these are interesting. They require a trusted third party, which is one of the problems. It also requires the anonymization channels that you need elsewhere anyway, too, so maybe a little bit more complex than necessary. Homomorphic encryption is a beautiful set of ideas for doing the addition while things are still encrypted. So the ballots are encrypted vectors of counts of how many times you vote for every candidate. So you might say, well, I vote once for George and none for Al or whatever, and you run down the list of candidates. And then those numbers are encrypted. You've got a vector of encrypted counts. And you have to have some issues we'll get into as to how you get encrypted votes, knowing that they can encode the right numbers and they're not too big or too negative or things like this. And then you have nice mathematical properties where you can actually add the votes together while they're encrypted. Here's an example of a encryption scheme due to Pierre, which has the homomorphic property you want. You'd like to have an encryption of a count of A votes for one candidate, an encryption of B counts for that same candidate. You multiply the ciphertext together, you get an encryption of A plus B. And an encryption scheme like this, which is Pierre's scheme, actually has that property. The encryption of A is just G, some generator raised to the eighth power, times some randomization quantity, R raised to the n power, mod n squared. Very pretty scheme that has lots of nice properties, including this homomorphic one. And with that, you can take a collection of encrypted ballots, add them together while encrypted, and then only at the very end, when you've got a vector of counts for each of the candidates, do the final decryption. You get those final counts then without revealing how any particular voter voted. Nice. It doesn't do write-in votes, which are one of the requirements, at least in American elections. So you'd like to have schemes that are a little more robust, can handle write-in votes as well. Perhaps the most flexible technologies are mixed nets, which were introduced by David Chaum, and various forms of mixed nets make use within. You guys have seen a lot of this stuff already, maybe in the more asynchronous model than the synchronous model that we'll be talking about here. But mixed nets then provide the anonymity you want for voting. They permute the ballots while they're encrypted and re-encrypted while doing so. Talk a little bit about that. So Chaum and Neff are the pioneers for application of mixed nets to voting. Voter verified secret ballots is the buzzword that Chaum likes to use. They're voter verified because you've got a process for telling that the encryption really encrypts what you want. They're secret because they're encrypted. So the official ballot with these schemes is now electronic and not paper. That's the big step you'd like to be able to make. How do you get rid of the paper altogether and have some electronic record be your vote? And the electronic record is going to be electronic is going to be ciphertext. So we have a couple of problems. And how do you get to the ciphertext reliably, and how do you then use the ciphertext reliability, removing the name of the voters? So you have anonymity. So that's the first design step, is make the ballots electronic and make the ballots an encryption of your choices. All the ballots then get posted on a public bulletin board. So that's one of the architectural features of all these schemes. There's a public bulletin board. It's append only. Part of the information that goes there will be maybe your name together with your ballot. So you could say, Hari Balakrishnan, and then the Hari's ballot. But it's a piece of ciphertext, so nobody can really see how Hari voted. But that's the input to the tally process then. Right, so that's the midpoint of the computation. So this public bulletin board is an important thing. And there's a lot of interesting system design questions about how to do that well. But it's not as hard as some of the other things we know how to do. The voter gets a paper receipt, which is a copy of the ballot that is a copy of the ciphertext, so she can ensure that her ballot is properly posted. There'd be some protest procedure. She says, my ballot didn't appear on the public website. She can protest and show her piece of paper, which is presumably assigned by an election official when she got it, and then get that reposted. And you can detect voting machine error fraud if it's been changed. So that's the high-level picture. So now let's dive into some of the parts of what the details look like here. So we've got a couple of problems. We've made a design choice that the ballot is an encryption of your choices. So how do you do that in a voting booth? In the old days, in the voting literature, it was wonderfully easy because you would assume that every voter was a computer. And it would start off saying, well, the voter picks a 1,000-digit random number and raises it to the power whatever mod n, and so that you do this computation in your head. So that doesn't work too well in practice. right? Unless you've got a trusted device for it. And that's one of the things that the modern literature does not assume, is that you've got trusted devices. So you've got a voter, Alice, who goes to the voting booth, wants to create a piece of ciphertext representing her choices, and doesn't have a trusted device for doing so, and isn't a computer herself, obviously. So she can't compute, and moreover, she can't take away anything that would allow her to prove how she voted. Right, so how do you have an experience for the voter? The voter walks in, expresses her choices, ends up with a piece of ciphertext that she has confidence in, that she has reason to believe really represents her choices. And if it's not correct, there's some protest procedure. So she'll take away some evidence. So some of the computation gets deferred. She'll take away some quantities that she can check later. And if they're not correct, that they show the machine was cheating, and you can nail the computer for being fraudulent, but doesn't in any case allow her to prove how she voted. So how do you do that? How do you have get a piece of ciphertext that provably captures how you want to vote when 1,000-bit numbers are not something you deal with naturally? So here's a feasibility argument that shows that this kind of thing is doable in principle. Right, so the voter gets, so you can imagine the machine doing this twice. The machine encrypts your choices twice. And encryption these days is always randomized, so when you encrypt something a second time, you get a different result because there's a different random seed that goes into it. So you can have the same plain text, but two different ciphertexts, of course. So she gets two different printed representations of her choices. So the voting machine is committed to those two encryptions, both of which are alleged to be correct representations of her vote. And she chooses one at random, and she casts that one as her vote. And then the other one is what she's going to check with. The other one, she gets the random seed, get a printout of that random seed for that. So given the random seed, you can check the correctness of the encryption. So you can decrypt if you like. So there's a little bit of a problem here, right, if you're following, right? Because then she can prove how she voted. So it has to be possible in principle to get encryptions and seeds for things other than your actual choices. And so she can say, I want to vote for so-and-so, get two printouts, maybe cast one of them, then say, I want to vote for somebody else, get two printouts, maybe take one of those home. She gets to choose what she wants to take home. We're just checking the correct operating of this encryption device here by getting the machine to commit to things before it knows which one is going to be checked later. So do a cut and choose. And so she can walk home with a ciphertext and the seed for decrypting it. She can check that the decryption is proper and that it meets the input requirements. And if a machine is cheating, then you've got at least a half a chance of catching the machine cheating on that. So that's a feasibility argument. I don't claim that this is really what you'd want to do on a voting system. It's a feasibility argument. You can end up with ciphertext that accurately captures your choices as a voter, even though you're not able to do sophisticated computations. More practically, here's a voting scheme that I think has got a nice user interface due to Peter Ryan from England, and it's paper-based. So we have a ballot, which is a piece of paper. So again, we're getting a little bit away from the electronic record, at least at the input stage, because we're going to be dealing with paper here, and then this will become electronic shortly. So we deal with a ballot which has candidates listed on the left in some pseudo-random order. So Smith, Jones, and Kent are the candidates. The paper is perforated down the middle. The voter makes an X to indicate who she chooses as a random seed here. The seed is the generating seed for the pseudo-random order that's used here. So these orders change from ballot to ballot, and this seed is the seed that determines what that order is. So the voter makes her choice, splits the ballot in half along the perforation, detaches and destroys the left-hand side. Now, from a user interface viewpoint, that's one of the hard parts of this scheme, right? Telling a voter they have to destroy something, I think, is actually going to be tough in practice, or ensuring that they destroy it. They'll probably stuff it in their pocket and walk out or whatever, but modulo that, right? So they're supposed to destroy the left-hand side. All they're left with then is this right-hand side, which they get to keep a copy of and take home, and they deposit the original as their vote, so that they get a receipt. So you can have the right-hand sides posted on a bulletin board, and the voter can take the receipt that she got and say, yeah, that actually is posted. So my vote is, the way I cast it, it's recorded, it's in the pile of input ballots that's going to be tallied. So getting the cast as intended is sort of clearly done properly here, under the assumption that the ballots all have the correct mapping between these seeds and the orderings here. So if the ballots were pre-printed incorrectly, you'd have a problem. And you can do an audit procedure the morning of the election to check that they're, you know, take half of the ballots and just check the computation from the seed to the ordering to see that you've got the correct ordering here, that the integrity of the ballots is proper. So you can have high confidence that the votes are all cast as intended. So that's the first part of the process, getting the voter to cast encrypted ballots with confidence. So you've got from intent to electronic record, these are scanned now and posted to something on the public bulletin board. That step can be done with confidence. Then how do you do anonymization? So those of you that have seen Mixnet, I imagine many of you here have, this will be very familiar. How do you get the anonymization? All of this is a little different than standard because you're not interested, as we'll see, in just getting anonymization, but you want provably correct anonymization. So the model here is you start off with your plain text choices, what's in the voter's head. You have the first level of encryption, so the previous slides got us to this point where you've got some sort of encryption of the voter's intent. But now they're still associated with the voter. You may have the first line of the website saying, you know, Hari Balakrishnan, and here's Hari's vote, which is a piece of ciphertext. You've got all the votes for everybody. They're still associated with the voters' names. How do you then get to the point where you've got an anonymized list of ciphertext corresponding to everybody's vote? So you have a collection of mixed servers. Each mixed server randomly permutes the ballots that it's got, changes the order, and in order to, you can't tell how they change the order, you've obviously got to re-encrypt or re-randomize again, too. So that's part of the process. So if the first ballot comes in here and goes out there, this actually looks different than that, obviously. Otherwise, things would be trivial. Each server has its own secret permutation. By the end of the set of mixed servers, you've got a permuted set of ballots, which nobody can correlate with these because they've all been reordered and re-randomized. And then finally, you can decrypt and get all the plain text ballots out again. So these plain text choices should be the same as these plain text inputs if everything worked correctly. And of course, we have to worry about it working correctly. So all of these intermediate results are going to get posted on a bulletin board, and you'll see why in just a second, but it has to do with this provability question. As long as there's at least one server that's honest, the permutation here will be unknown to anyone. So that's how you achieve anonymization. And this deals nicely with write-in votes as well. That's the problem we had with homomorphic encryption and so on, too, was that you can't deal with write-in votes. Write-in votes traditionally have the problem that you can't deal with any better here than elsewhere, which is if you vote for some name that nobody else votes for, you may be tagging your vote that way. But aside from that issue, this text here could be anything, and it comes out the other end just fine. So we've got three parts: encryption, mixing, decryption. So now we want to argue for the possibility of proving the integrity of these latter steps. So everybody wants proof that the votes were counted the way they were cast, that all this mixing and decryption and everything works properly. So it's not so easy because the mixed servers, if they're working correctly, can't reveal how they reordered things. I mean, it would be easy for them to prove that they were doing their job properly if they were allowed to reveal how they did it and what the reordering was and what the re-encryption seeds were and so on. But they can't do that. The whole point is that this reordering is secret so that we have anonymity of the voting process. So they can't reveal that. And you also have the problem of having the final decryption be provably correct. The final decryption trustees have to decrypt something, so they come up with a plain text and they say, this is the decryption. They have to prove that they did that properly. That's usually pretty easy to do. If you decrypt, you often get the randomization seed or whatever, and you can go back and you can make it clear that you did the decryption properly. But the permutation, the mixnets, is the harder part. So there's this notion of a robust mix. A robust mix is a mixed server that provides proof that it worked properly. See, it not only does the permutation, but it provides this proof or evidence that anybody can check that the set of inputs here and the set of outputs here are the same in the sense that these are ciphertexts, these are ciphertexts, but the set of plain text is the same as you move through the mix server. So this mix is doing its job properly. If this set is the same as that set, the mix server wants not only to do its job properly, but to convince you that it's done its job properly with a proof that anybody can check. So how do you do that? I'd like this to be universally verifiable. So we have confidence. Any voter can check that all the votes were tallied properly. You can have a high school class that writes programs that checks that the vote was counted properly, even though you're dealing with large collections of ciphertexts. You'd like this to be the case that even if all of the mixes are corrupt, it's going to be impossible for them to cheat. And this proof does not reveal the input-output correspondence. So how do you do that? So there's lots of proposals for how to deal with that. Let me show you one approach that we came up with, Marcus Jacobson, Ari Jules, and myself. It's very simple. So the idea is that each mix server should reveal half of its input-output correspondences. It's really a generalization of the cut-and-choose thing that we already saw. So, and we'll do this in such a way that there's no complete path from input to output through the sequence of mixed servers. So at the end, your anonymity is preserved with at least, you know, within a set of half the voters and probably much better than that. And I'll have a figure that makes this a little clearer. But the security property you end up with at the end is that an adversary who tries to cheat and modify a large number of votes, like T votes, has a probability that goes down exponentially with T of being able to do so and create a proof that corresponds. So that it may be the case that an adversary could change the count by one vote with probability a half or two votes with probability a quarter and so on. But by the ability to rig an election and change a large number of votes, more than a dozen or two, becomes insignificant. So for voting purposes, this is a practical proposition. So how does this randomized partial checking actually work? So again, we've got the encryption here. We've got the mix server. So we'll take the mix servers and we'll pair them up. So the first two get paired, at least for the purposes of this checking operation, and so on. The other ones get paired. So the structure is the same, except we've got this pairing of mix servers. And what we'll do is we'll look at the intermediate results between those two mix servers. And for each one of those intermediate results, that's a ciphertext produced by the left-hand mix server, we'll come up with a random bit. This random bit will be actually pseudo-random, so everybody can check that it was done properly and in a way that's not influenceable by anyone. So that random bit might be computed as a hash of a bit out of the hash of everything that's on the bulletin board. So we get a random bit for this guy, a random bit for that guy, a random bit for this guy. And the random bits determine which way the challenge goes. If the random bit is a zero, that means it's a challenge to the left-hand mix server. And the left-hand mix server is forced to reveal the randomization factors in that part of the permutation that says, where does that guy come from? So we get a zero here and say, where does that come from? Well, the mix server says, well, he comes from over here. He's input number two, goes to output number one. So I'm revealing that part of the permutation, and I reveal the randomization factor that allows me to prove that that's the case. So that part of the secret permutation is busted open. It's made public. But because that's only a one-way challenge, where it goes to the next step is not revealed. So that's a dead end as far as anybody trying to figure out what happens after that. Nobody can see what happens next because that's part of the hidden half for the next server. And so on. The next bit might also be a zero, reveal this. The third bit might be a one, so the second server has to prove where that guy went to symmetrically. So each pair of servers has a set of challenges, one for each ciphertext. When they reveal all of them, you've got good confidence that each of those servers is doing its job properly. If it's trying to change any significant fraction of its votes, when you're checking half of them, you've got a good chance of seeing some of them that got changed. So it's a high assurance check. And nonetheless, because they're paired like this and the challenges go left-right, you have no path that goes all the way through this thing. There's no way to trace a vote through the entire mix network and find out where something went. So that's the idea for randomized partial checking. Very practical, works well. There are other proposals for getting robust mixes which allow you to have higher confidence and go all the way through without this half business. But I think this is actually probably the best way of doing it. The other schemes get much more complicated mathematically, and this is a pretty simple idea, and it works for any encryption scheme. Here's an even more far-out idea that one of my PhD students came up with, Benedita. Public mixing. So the goal is to achieve anonymity. Here's a way of sort of having public mixing, having the public be able to do the permutation in a way that nobody can tell how it's done. So how does that work? This is a really cool idea. And it's practical for medium-sized elections. Computational complexity gets a little out of hand for very large elections, but it's workable for precinct level things certainly. So you've got a vector of inputs, which is your ciphertext. We're going to do a matrix vector multiplication, but it's not the usual matrix vector multiplication with everything's plain text. Here, both the matrix and the vector are going to be encrypted, and we're going to come up with an encrypted vector result. So everything is going to be just a case of encrypted computation, if you will, where all the inputs are encrypted, and you come out with an encrypted result, and the person doing the computation doesn't know anything about the plain text inputs or the plain text outputs or how they correspond. So the matrix is an encryption of a 0-1 permutation matrix. So you get a permutation out of matrix vector multiplications if the matrix is a permutation matrix. It's created initially and proved correct by trustees in a distributed manner at setup time. So the equivalent of the mix servers here are just used to create this encrypted matrix. And the vector is, of course, the vector of encrypted cast ballots. That's the input vector you have after the encryption step. And now we use the Bonego-Nissim crypto system, which supports homomorphic evaluation of polynomials of degree at most 2. They can't do it for more than 2, but it works for degree 2. And it uses some very interesting schemes based on elliptic curves, where you get the multiplication, which we just need one product to get degree 2. You can get a multiplication, but you have to switch elliptic curves to do that. So the output isn't a different elliptic curve system than the input. So you can do polynomials of degree 2. And matrix vector multiplication is really degree 2 polynomial evaluation, of course, too, right? You've got the row and the column, and you're just multiplying pairwise, and so that gives you degree 2 everywhere. So you can do that evaluation using the scheme to get a matrix vector product to work out. And it's based on pairing functions and bilinear maps, which is cool stuff and really had a lot of impact on cryptography recently. So the big picture is sort of this. Here, red is things are encrypted. Trustees initially produce this matrix, which is a permutation matrix. Each entry is a 0 or 1, but it's encrypted. It's a randomized encryption scheme. Every 0 and every 1 look different. So somewhere in here, there's embedded a permutation. And there's a proof that that's a permutation matrix. And again, that kind of proof is a proof that doesn't reveal what the permutation is. So you've got a nice encrypted permutation matrix here. You've got your set of encrypted votes. And now instead of having a collection of mixed servers, you have this multiplication operation that the public can do. Anybody can multiply this permutation matrix by this vector to come up with this encrypted vector. And so this is a set of ciphertext that has the same set of plain text as this. This multiplication operation does the permutation, does the re-randomization. So there's no way that anybody can really tell that this is a permutation of that. They know that it is. This proof anybody can check. They know this is a permutation matrix and so on too. So the anonymization, it's a cool operation. Anybody can do this anonymization without revealing. So the correctness of this is just relies on the correctness here rather than the correctness of the individual steps all the way through. So you can get anonymization that way. So it's a publicly computed secret permutation and re-encryption of the vote vector V. So there's another way of getting anonymization. So far we've been looking at crypto schemes and how to get crypto. One of the things one of the issues with cryptographic schemes with real voting is this issue of transparency. People worry that voters are going to say, wait, there's way too much math involved. I don't understand that. I mean, forgetting the fact they don't understand all the software that's involved anyway. I mean, that's sort of swept under the rug. And the software is in some ways much more complicated than the crypto. But so to have a transparent voting scheme, you'd like to make it as simple as possible and as clear as possible. So one of the things I've been thinking about is how to try to make these schemes crypto-free. You eliminate the crypto and have the same properties. Can you get the end? So we've seen how to get this end-to-end security property with cryptography. You can get cast as intended. You can get counted as cast using these combinations of voter verification and mixnets. And so the question is, do you really need all the cryptography to get that? Maybe there's some paper-based way to get that. So here's a proposal that starts us along that path and gets pretty far. It's not perfect. So this is called a three-ballot paper. So in this scheme, it's paper ballots. So you're not getting rid of the paper, but the goal here is to get end-to-end security using paper without the crypto. So each voter casts three ballots. So you're given three ballots, not one. And you're going to cast all three of them. And when you do the tally in the end, they all three get added up as if they were individual ballots. So there's three end ballots cast for end voters. And you have a constraint, though. You have to vote for each candidate for any race at least once, but not more than twice. It's kind of funky, right? So if you look at the tallies in the end, every candidate's count is deflated by exactly n, the number of voters, because everybody has to vote for every candidate at least once. And the candidate you really like, you vote for twice. So you're just biasing all the counts by n. So that you'll see why we do that. So that's the rules. And when you have your three ballots, and when you cast them, there's some process that checks that your three ballots together have the right property. Okay, so you cast all three of them. All three of them go on the public bulletin board. So they're dumped in a box when you vote. They're tossed around at random. They're scrambled. They go on a public bulletin board. So anybody can add them up. There's no encryption anymore. They're all plain text. Anybody can do the addition once you see them all posted. And the voter gets to take a copy of one of them home as a receipt. And so you've cast three ballots. They add up to what you want. You get one of them to take home as a receipt. Which one you take home as a receipt is up to you, and the voting officials don't know. There's some process by which you can get a copy of one of them without anybody else knowing which one you got a copy of. But you only get one. Okay. So the receipt doesn't indicate how you voted overall, because the other two that you don't take a copy of home can actually outvote the one that you took. You can put anything you like on the one that you got a copy of. Somebody says, I want to see you vote for ABC. You can vote for ABC, and you can have the other. I mean, that doesn't say you've got two votes in those lines. It just says you've got one. Every line has one vote in it. So you can put whatever you like in one. So there's no way you can sell your vote based on the receipt that you've got to take home. Let me show you a picture. So here's a ballot, right? So this is a valid three-ballot ballot. There's one vote in Alice's row. There's two in Bob's row. So this is actually a vote for Bob, one vote in Charles's row. So this is a vote for Bob for president. This is a vote for Erica as vice president. These ballots get cut apart. The individual ballots may not even be legal ballots by traditional things, like this is actually an overvote for president, but that's okay here. Okay, so these get separated, cast separately, and any one particular copy you get as a receipt doesn't, if I say this is a vote for Bob, it doesn't mean I necessarily voted for Bob. This is a vote for David here. I didn't actually vote for David. I voted for Erica. So this is the idea. So you get one as a receipt. So it has nice properties. You get some end-to-end verifiability. You can go to the bulletin board. You can use this identification number to check that your ballot was properly posted on the bulletin board. These have to be coded in a way that the voter can't remember all three of them or something. There's a little issue there with user interface to make that workable. But so that's the idea. So there's actually promise for getting voting with end-to-end security properties, maybe even without using cryptography. There's lots of interesting issues with the particular three-ballot scheme here in terms of, can you go through the pile of ballots and match up and find which three go together and so on. And there's, if the ballots get very long, there may be some possibilities of doing things like that. So it's not as perfect as the crypto system, but I think it shows promise for actually taking some of the ideas that arise in the crypto world and actually making them realizable without some of the crypto. So some of the interesting research we're involved in. So let me switch topics here and move on, close with some discussion of voting system standards. So that's another way we can try to improve voting systems, an area I've been involved in. As I said, these are personal. Anything I say here is personal opinions and not intended to be representative of any of these committees. So standards are a tough issue for improving voting systems. States can ignore them altogether by the federal structure of this country. States determine all the voting rules in general, except to the extent that the government persuades them otherwise by giving out money. So many states, though, require federal certification. There's new standards coming out. The next round will be coming out in July. I encourage you to take a peek at them and give feedback. They'll be taking effect in 2008. So we've made some improvements, I think, in the guidelines. For example, the current round of the current draft of these standards proposes software independence as a new notion which all voting systems must adhere to. It's a generalization of the notion of a voter-verified paper audit trail. It encompasses both of the paper ballot schemes and some of the crypto schemes and maybe some other things. So basically, the property one is a software bug or a piece of malware or whatever can't cause undetectable change in election outcome. That's a nice property to have. It says you're not requiring to get the integrity of the voting system on the belief, on trying to make sure the software is really correct. You don't need to have that. If there's a bug in the software, if the software got replaced the night before the election, or whatever reason, there's possibilities for detecting that something has gone wrong, either by the voter seeing, say, that the paper isn't printed right, or a post-election audit determining that something went wrong. So software independence is a more general notion here that basically says it's auditable. Right? You've got the election outcome is auditable. You've got a way of checking that the inputs and the outputs properly correspond to each other. So that's one in place that these standards have been improved. Red team evaluations for security, tiger teams, whatever you want to call them. So just an open-ended looking for vulnerabilities in these systems will be a new part of this. It's very different than the kinds of things these testing labs are used to. They like checklist kinds of things. They say, does it have a password? Is the password at least 6 characters? Blah, blah, blah. Those kinds of things are fine, but don't go very far. You really, for security purposes, you need to have, and you guys all know this already, so this is an improvement that's been made there. Wireless, some of these schemes have wireless in them and have had wireless, so that's going to be banned. There'll be some proper authentication for software and data, so you know that the software is distributed is checked either with hash codes or better digital signatures, and some of the data being transmitted around will be signed as well. So some of these things are getting beefed up. But there's lots of interesting issues still to be looked at, and the standards changes that we're pushing for don't address everything. In terms of relevance to this community, networks are starting to play a larger role in many voting systems. You not only have the voting systems themselves, which may be networked locally, but the standards say you can't network them externally. But now you've got the registration systems. When you check in to vote, they look up your name, and some of these systems get networked to each other, and they get networked to a statewide database because states are now starting to support vote centers and things like this where you can vote in a precinct different than where you live, and you have to have some sort of check to see that you haven't voted twice. So now you've got a statewide network, potentially. You've got a statewide network connected to an electronic poll book. Electronic poll book check is where the voter checks in. The poll book may be, in principle, connected electronically to the voting stations themselves, and you've got a path there for potential corruption or problems, denial of service attacks, whatever, who knows what. So there's a question as to making sure you've got air gaps in the network somewhere here. Source code availability, this is one of the things the HOPE bill addresses. Source code will, of course, be made available to the testing labs. You've got vendor-written software, you've got operating systems and so on, too, that commercial off-the-shelf software that needs to be evaluated. How do you evaluate Windows CE as a foundation for a voting system, right, et cetera? Not so easy. Support for auditing procedures is improved. Setup validation. Is there some way to check at the beginning of the day that all the bits in that voting machine are properly set up? The gambling industry does a wonderful job at this. If you look at the standards for gambling machines in Vegas, they're in many ways much tougher than they are for voting machines, and they've got good ways of telling that the software and the firmware in a gambling machine is set up properly. And a voting machine is a little harder to do. We'd like to see that improved. Documentation, use of cryptography, interoperability standards, et cetera. So lots of things happening there. So to conclude, voting technology, it's an interesting problem. There's lots of things happening, lots of moving parts. It's a sloppy industry. There's technology involved. There's people involved. There's places where better technology can play a role, better procedures, clear thinking. There's lots of hype and dogma, too, but there's actually places for lots of good academic research as well. And it does seem it's possible to have electronic voting without having to trust the machines for integrity. Right? We can get the software independence. We can use cryptography. We can have voter verification of one way or the other to mean that you don't have to trust the machine software to know that your vote was recorded properly. And we don't need to have paper ballots for recounts. We can have everything electronic and posted on a website. and without revealing how any voter votes. That's, as I said, the tough problem there. So there is promise that we can achieve, at least technically, a lot of the things we'd really like to have for security properties here. But getting all this done well, getting it in a way that's really usable for the voter and so on, too, and dealing with a lot of the other issues that are coming online, like these networked issues for the poll books and so on, is still wide open. So there's lots of research to be done, and I encourage you to look at these issues. So I'll stop there and be happy to take any questions you might have. Hi.
My name is Petros Maniatis from Intel. What I was wondering, you must get this question a lot. Do you have any feel or any hope that we can get to a level of public scrutiny for the verifiable parts of the schemes that you've talked about, some of them for cryptography, some of them without, that the general public will be able to conduct? I mean, on average, people can't point to Canada on a map. Can they do multiplications in an elliptic curve group in a way to verify the results? Do you have any hope that we can do this?
So the way I'd look at this, it's a great question. You'd like to have public confidence in the voting systems. Confidence in a piece of complex technology is usually indirect. So you'd like to say, well, is the information at least potentially available? So if I had the expertise, I could evaluate it. So you'd like to have source code available. You'd like to have all of the cryptographic protocols clearly published, whatever documentation be public. So everything should be public. And then if you don't yourself have the expertise to evaluate something, you'd like to know that, well, it is public, you can trust your own expert. You can say, well, I don't trust my own ability to evaluate this, but you know, the ACLU has a cryptographer that I trust, or as a software evaluator that I trust, or EFF, or the Republican Party, or whoever you want to trust. You know, it will be publicly evaluable by experts of organizations that you trust. I think that kind of indirect evaluation is what you'd have to, in the end, how people develop confidence.
Mark Cherini, Tufts University. I was just wondering if anybody's given any thought to using things like USB keys or virtual PCs on them, or you know, virtual whatever you want to call it, as just a way of having somebody come from home and just plug something in.
So this would, the information contained, this would be, there's a couple of ways that could be used. I mean, one is just a memory card to store, and I like the idea of being able to come in with sort of my vote sort of initially cast on my PC at home, and then I preload, so I just save time at the voting station. So that's one issue. But then if it's used as an authentication token or even as a computational token, that's a different thing. I'm not sure which part of that you're asking, or maybe all of them.
I guess all of them. It occurs to me that you would be able to perhaps generate some hashes that would verify basically anywhere you took this, and you know, kind of like a universal credit card or whatever you want to call it, which has its own issues, I understand that. But I'm just wondering if anybody has looked into using sort of portable.
So I think that's a great direction to look at. I mean, I think you know, as the electronic infrastructure just sort of continues to build up, you know, we have this issue, particularly for security-relevant applications like this, that you know, you need something to be your electronic agent that you trust in these transactions. So when you're purchasing something, when you're voting, somehow the interface between you and the electronic infrastructure needs to be done by a trusted electronic agent. So my mental model for this in the future is, you know, it's your cell phone, but it's a cell phone that's done in a trusted way. So you can take the cell phone into your voting booth. Maybe there's a problem with cell phones in voting already because most of them take pictures now, and that would violate voter privacy. You can say, but if putting that aside, you know, just having something, some gadget that you can take in that you trust, that really represents you, you can solve a lot of problems nicely that way. And so I think that's a direction that would be worth going in. But I think we're a long ways from actually having it. It's the same problem with PCs as your trusted agent, right? If your phone is part of a botnet, you know, you've got a problem as well. So
also on the issue of cost, low cost for you know poorer voters and things like that. But
yeah, there's a lot of issues there with the whole ID card thing is being debated already, and that's related to this as well. Is for voter authentication. But having an electronic agent introduces the problems of computer security, of course, and I think those are not easy.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks.
It's a fantastic topic and a fantastic talk. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
My question is, most of the schemes that you discussed provide accountability, so they allow me to detect if there's been manipulation, but they cannot produce the correct result in the event of manipulation. I'm wondering, is that actually a problem in practice, or is there some hidden requirement that's unstated that it should not be too easy for an attacker to render a given election invalid?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, you'd like it to be the case that they're robust in the face of manipulation, so that first, certainly a small amount of manipulation, may not, even though you know there's been manipulation, you don't care because the election result is still sound. But if there's a large amount of manipulation, if you don't have paper records to go back to, say, or something like that, you may have a hard time doing a recount, coming up with the correct result. If the electronic, say, records were all destroyed, I mean, any kind of storage device, you have the problem of just sort of massive destruction of them, which I guess is massive tampering. So you have to have procedures in place which, and personnel that you trust that can guard these things pretty well. It's a great question.
Günther, Cornell University. Yep. I really enjoyed your talk, but I have to say I found it both refreshing and frustrating at the same time.
Good.
You're talking about very advanced technology here, and in the public discourse, the things that we're talking about are very, very, what I would call retarded things. Like currently, the guidelines already say that voting machines have to do a self-check, and Diebold discharges that requirement by doing a RAM check. So that's quite a perversion of what the guideline is supposed to do, and somehow that passes for acceptable. So, and of course, then there's a whole discussion about whether or not we can have paper ballots. And
there's a big gap between some of the stuff that what we in academia think about and what's happening in practice, and there's a real challenge to try to bridge that gap and bring technology as it's shown to be workable, raise the level.
So my question is indeed, how do we actually bridge that gap? How do we take the public discourse so that some of these systems could actually be deployed in practice?
So I think getting involved in various ways is a good first step is to be a poll worker and get a sense as to what's happening out there in practice, and then get involved with your local elections. So everything's local really, and work with your state government to write standards. I mean, because it's all state law typically. So if you can get the state law to raise the bar, that's a great way of doing it. And a lot of states have bars that are higher than the federal bars. Yep.
Hi, Dave Maltz from Microsoft Research. I have two related questions. As you pointed out, if I can interfere with the voter registration problem or the checking off of voters, if I can interfere with the voter registration problem or the checking off of voters as they come in, I can prevent particular demographics from voting and sway the election in that way. Now, could you say a little bit more about sort of research that's happening there or sort of the technical problems there? And just to finish the question, the traditional answer here has been provisional ballots. So if someone shows up and the database says they can't vote, whether due to a malicious attack or human screw-up in creating the database, they can create a vote that can be counted later if it turns out they should be able to vote. But now the crypto system for voting has to be able to sort of retain a matching between the person and the vote up until some point in time at which it then needs to be thrown away. And are there any voting systems that can handle provisional ballots?
Yeah, great question. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Most of the problems with voting have, in practice these days, seem to have to do with voting registration and people being disenfranchised because they're not on the ballots when they should, on the registration rolls when they should be. So database integrity, a lot of it's procedural and legal as to, who's allowed to vote and what kinds of public review of the decisions made are there and so on too. So a lot of those are not so technical, but they're just sort of legal and procedural. The crypto schemes have the property that they do, in fact, nicely provide for. Where's my MixNet slide? Here we go. Do provide for provisional ballots. And by the way, provisional ballots were something really that were proposed first by the Caltech MIT project, and then got adopted by law. So that's one of the big accomplishments of this. Project that we had was proposing provisional ballots. They've had a large positive effect. With a cryptographic scheme, at this point you've got the encrypted ballot, but also the voter's name attached. So if you are here, you've got name, ciphertext. And if you wait until all the provisional ballots are checked to see who's allowed to vote, you can remove some of these input lines or add more ones if you need to do that. So the crypto schemes, because they allow you to keep voter privacy while maintaining the binding between the voter name and the encrypted ballot, actually work better for provisional ballots than some of the traditional ones where you're depending more on procedural things like having envelopes inside of envelopes and so on too, which is what they traditionally do. So they work well for this. Yeah. Good question.
Hi.
I
have a follow-up to Peter's question on tampering.
Yes.
So it seems like there are different types of tamper detection. One is you could just detect that the ballot is tampered, but not how, just because there's some inconsistency. Or you could detect that it's tampered in a certain way. Like this vote was actually meant to be cast for B, but it's been tampered with, and you know there's a vote cast for A. So how many of these schemes give you sort of a strong tamper detection like that, where you could actually go back and maybe reverse the count, versus just detecting an inconsistency?
So with some of these things, you could, if you have a mixed server here that fails to produce a correct proof that they've operated correctly, so maybe say server 2 is detected tampering with the votes, you know the inputs, if you have reason to believe that the inputs to mixed server 2 are correct, but the outputs have been tampered with, then you can go back at this level and just replace server 2 by some other server. You just cross them off of the process, take the next mixed server and have him do the remixing. So there are ways to recover. So a lot of them have that property. That's usually at the level of the aggregate rather than the individual ballot, in that sense. It's a great question. You'd like to be able to recover whenever possible. Some of these crypto schemes have that nice property that you can tell that the proof failed, therefore this mixed server was cheating. You go back, throw him out of the loop, take his inputs and reprocess with somebody else.
Rick Vero, you mentioned validation, and still my favorite example of a validatable scheme was the Kaping, Hurst, Wagner, and Bullivant paper last summer, right? 376 lines of Python for the voting machine software. Anything happening with that?
That's still bubbling along. That's a wonderful idea. So everything's pre-rendered. You have a small finite state machine written in Python that displays the screens, and it shows if you touch this part of the screen, you just do that transition, and then it's a great idea. I have heard, I think, that some of the voting machine companies are talking with them about doing that, but I've also heard that the state machines get rather large with some of the complexities of ballots. With many of the funky state laws we have, you not only have to support every language that a voter might vote in, but you also have to support random orders for every voter of the candidates. So that there's a bias. If you don't care about the election, that race, you tend to vote for the first candidate. So some of the state laws say they've got to have either rotations or randomizations there. So when you start bringing some of these other considerations into play, the state machines actually get pretty large. And so the feasibility of this is, at least for Los Angeles or places like that, maybe get to be a bit dicey. But I think in general it's a great idea, and I would like to see more research towards engineering extreme simplicity into these machines.
Thanks
for the reference. That's a good pointer. Yep.
Hi, Ryan Peterson, Cornell. So I'm interested in these mixed net voting systems, but one implementation I saw, PunchScan, had a Slashdot article with hundreds of comments, and all these technically savvy people just did not understand the whole concept of a zero knowledge proof. And so I have this idea that we have some experts who understand the voting system, but then a lot of people who other people would perceive as experts saying that it doesn't work. And so then you have this kind of battle where you're forcing small town USA people to choose which people they believe. And I'm wondering if this is something you could fix sort of even in the educational system, where you can say, this is a fundamental part of our country and how we vote.
So I think when you've got some technical, it's a great question. So the question is how to deal with the educational aspect of these schemes. And I think it just takes time. So, I mean, my own mental model for new technologies, it takes 15 to 20 years typically to get it into play. And a lot of that time is just for people to digest what it's about. I mean, public key took a long time before it really took off in practice. I think any kind of zero knowledge based voting scheme will take a while for people to digest it, get prototypes up, get places to use it. There's a nice example of some of these things happening this summer. There's a contest for student voting system this summer, which is being judged in Portland, Oregon this July. So you start having student competitions for new innovative voting system designs and so on. So this stuff bubbles up and eventually gets small pilot elections and it builds up over time. I think the initial commentary may be a bit confused at first, and that's what we're seeing here. Yeah. In the end, the truth will win out.
Thank you, Ron, for a great talk.
Thanks, Ari.